Good morning, everybody. My name is Daniel Lombardi. Welcome to the War College here at Celesticon. We're going to have a whole series of really interesting talks. We have some handouts that we can give you before you leave today. I'd also like to let you know that Frank Chadwick, our guest of honor, is going to be here as well talking later today. He's the last talk about writing science fiction. He has gotten two books out, one on a steampunk series and another one on hard science fiction. Those two are both published, and he's working on the second one in the series about the hard science fiction. He'll be talking about writing science fiction, how to get published and so forth later today at 7:30. Tomorrow he'll be talking on the surface battles at Guadalcanal. So he's going to have quite a bit to tell us. We have a whole raft of other people who are going to be talking on World War I and other subjects here at the convention, including Jack Green, who's here, talking about World War I naval ships, battleships, and battlecruisers, and also why World War II happened out of World War I. One of the reasons we're doing World War I so much this year is because it's the start of the centennial. 100 years ago, the armies all started marching in August, and the great battles in the west towards Paris and in the east, Tannenberg, all started and led to the most unprecedented conflict.
You know, I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you close the door here?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
There's a lot of racket out there.
Yeah. Maybe we could ask the guy to move down, please. Well, actually, if you could ask him just to move down, he's
you know, no, that guy. It's all right.
There we go. That's
good. That?
All right. That might be better. All right. Anyway, so I'm going to start about World War I here in terms of why did it start? Because this conflict was on a scale and in such slaughter and destruction of property and civilian casualties that was just unprecedented. And it used the full might of industrial societies in Europe and the United States on a scale, again, that had never been done before. So one of the questions is, why did this happen? Why did such a terrible war begin in 1914? This is all based upon a very famous historian in the United States, Michael Nyberg. He is a professor of history in the Department of National Security and Strategy at the United States Army War College at Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And he gave this talk back last year at the National World War I Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. I was there, I talked with Michael. He is an amazing lecturer, and I thought that sharing that, and he agreed to let us share that information. My version is abbreviated, and I've thrown in a few other things, especially about alternative histories and so forth, because we're all gamers and we like to see that sort of thing. But what he was presenting was that it was a new look at an old problem. In other words, there were already ways that historians have explained what happened. In fact, there were people at the time, right in the middle of it, who were trying to explain, how could this possibly happen? How could we have such a terrible war when, you know, the bankers, the economists, the politicians, there were many people, labor unions, they all said, this war can't happen. I'll get into that in a minute, but there were a lot of people saying this possibly couldn't happen, and we've avoided it in the past. How could we stumble into war like this? So the way that it has been taught historically since World War I up to this point has been, in a traditional sense, using the acronym MAIN, M-A-I-N, which stands for Militarism, Alliances, Imperialism, and Nationalism. In other words, these are the four main categories that most people have been taught were the reasons why the nations in Europe finally got into war. And I'll go through those individually. The first one, militarism. The armies and the navies all had huge costs to keep, you know, standing armies and navies going. Britain obviously had the largest navy in the world at the time. Germany was in sort of a naval arms race with them, which, by the way, they had lost. They knew by 1912 Germany was not going to catch Great Britain. It wasn't going to happen. And so they stopped doing it as aggressively because they just knew they were not going to be able to catch Great Britain, because Great Britain, of course, reacted to that. As Germany built more battle cruisers and more destroyers and so forth, Britain did too. So, you know, you could never catch up. It was like, you know, impossible. So again, it's like, all right, so they rebalanced their forces. Why did this happen? The military also was very respected in most countries. Now, despite the fact that we know, we're looking back, we see the Germans with their spiked helmets, and we think that Germany was a police state and you know, had all the militaristic aspects that we've come now to look down upon. The fact is that Great Britain and a lot of other countries also had a military that had a lot of control and a lot of say over their civilians and about their political life. In France, for example, the Dreyfus Affair had just happened, and within a few years that tore France apart and made a lot of the military men go into the, you know, pro-military, anti-Semitic, anti-Dreyfus camp, and then others who were appalled by this. And religion was part of it, politics was part of it, so France was torn up. Great Britain had issues, obviously, with Ireland. Ireland wanted to be free and independent. That included Ulster, the northern part of Ireland, where a lot of the British officers were from, and they refused to, they were going to mutiny and not put down any kind of insurrection in Ireland, and they refused to see Ireland become independent. That meant losing Northern Ireland out of Great Britain's control. So there was militarism all over the place, but a lot of it was projected inward. Okay, it wasn't projected outward towards other countries necessarily. Everyone knew we had to have a military to protect our nation, to protect our interests. Okay, but militarism by itself was not going to cause the war. The next thing, of course, were alliances. Now, alliances were initially sought for defensive purposes. We want to have alliances to help us fight our enemies, because by our country by itself cannot possibly defeat all the enemies we're up against. And there were basically two main groups. There was the Triple Entente, which was Russia, France, and Great Britain. And Russia and France formed an alliance in 1894. The reason that's important is prior to that, Russia was allied with Germany. Germany and Russia had a long, long-standing alliance. And when Kaiser Wilhelm II dismissed Bismarck and got a new foreign policy man, they let it lapse. They let that agreement lapse, and France jumped in and got the agreement with Russia, because they both had interests against Germany, which of course made Germany even more paranoid and more defensive. They were able to pull Great Britain into this Triple Entente, this alliance. There's argument about how formalized it was, but the fact is there were assurances given to both France and Russia by Great Britain, and there were interests. This, by the way, is also unprecedented. Britain and France have been at war for hundreds of years. Okay? So they were quite happy fighting each other. So the idea, and by the way, in 1870, when Prussia had defeated France, Britain stayed out of it and just watched. Okay, so there was a precedence here that Britain could have just sat this out and said, okay, you guys take care of it. You know, we have no interest here, right? We don't care what's going on. But instead, Great Britain had made assurances to France and Russia, and those were very important. The excuse was used by Great Britain that they had treaty obligations to protect Belgium. And that was a big, major reason why Great Britain said they had to get involved in the war. But the fact is, if they didn't have this obligation, I really doubt that, you know, Germany walking through Belgium would have caused Great Britain to jump into the war. On the other hand, Germany and Austria-Hungary, which makes sense, Austria-Hungary was run by the German-speaking Austrians, even though Hungary was the part of the dual monarchy, as they called it. Hungary was independent, but part of the whole thing. And they had a lot of different nationalities. I think it was like 22 different nationalities and different languages in Austria-Hungary. Germany now was a unified nation, which had not existed before 1871. This is very important. It's a young country. And they have all the problems of young countries with, you know, status, you know, their situation with the world, the way they're viewed by other Europeans, whereas Great Britain and France, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years have as a nation. Germany didn't have that. So they're still establishing themselves, which meant they also wanted to say that they were first-tier nation as well. Italy was part of this. It was originally the Triple Alliance, and Italy, strangely enough, was involved in this. We're not sure exactly what they were going to get out of it, since the only territory they could possibly get was going to come out of Austria-Hungary. So how that all worked was In 1914, when the war actually started, Italy said, no, we're not going to be part of this, and they decided to be neutral. And then Great Britain, Russia, and France said, no, no, we'll bribe you. You can have as much as Austria or Hungary as you want, you know, just come in on our side, which is exactly what they did the following year. And of course, in the middle of all this were the Balkans, which caused it with a spark that initially was going to lead to the war. And there was a First and Second Balkan War fought that the big powers were not involved in, but they got involved to try and settle it because they didn't want it getting out of hand. So that's another reason why a lot of people were thinking, why did this escalate and no one put the brakes on it? At the edge of all this is the Ottoman Empire, which is called the sick man of Europe. The Ottoman Empire, or Turkey as we know it today, had a vast area. Egypt, Libya, Arabia, the area that we know as Iraq and Syria and others, those did not exist. They were all part of the Ottoman Empire. But it was a very weak empire, and it performed very poorly during the Balkan Wars. Bulgaria and Serbia, Montenegro, all took vast territories in the Balkans from the Ottomans, and the Ottomans were squished back to just about 50 miles or so from Istanbul. And of course then had most of the Middle East. So no one really regarded the Ottoman Empire with much credibility. They had very little respect for its army, or its navy was nearly non-existent. But because of the way it was treated by Russia, France, and Britain, it was pushed to Germany and Austria-Hungary, which is, again, unusual because the Ottomans had been fighting Austria-Hungary for hundreds of years. In fact, the Ottomans had tried to take Vienna twice. So you have this sort of, it's like the old style of diplomacy and warfare going on, except now they've got industrial-sized armies, industrial-sized weapons, but they're still trying to play at this like the old way of the boardroom and the politics as usual. Now, the other one is imperialism, M-A-I-N, I is imperialism. Well, in order to be a first-tier country on this planet, you had to have colonies, okay? The irony is that most colonies were not cost-effective. In fact, they were huge drains because they didn't produce a lot, and they certainly didn't buy a lot. They were poor nations. You can see Africa alone. This doesn't show the whole world, but you can just see that the blue is Great Britain, the red is French, and most of this was like empty. You have the Spanish, which is a little bit darker right there, Portuguese, Belgian, Congo, German, they jumped in and got a few pieces, and Italy, of course, had its own. So, I mean, the only ones independent were a few nations in Africa. But it shows that you to be considered, you know, a serious first-tier nation, you had to have colonies, and so they were in competition for that. However, there was already competition for this and conflict. The Fashoda incident between Great Britain and France was resolved peaceably. You know, because remember, again, France and Great Britain had been at war for many years. They were in conflict over colonies. And they said, you know, we're not going to fight over this. We're just going to have a gentleman's agreement, slice these people up. They don't, you know, they're not going to have any say. And that's what we're going to do. And then Germany had two incidents in Morocco where they were trying to get their foot in the door and take territory away from France. But again, those two incidences were resolved peaceably. Kaiser said, this is not worth fighting for. So you wonder, you had three major incidents here, right? And the two Balkan Wars, none of those end up in war between the major powers. Why did it happen? Finally, you've got nationalism. Now, Germany and Britain, despite their rivalry in naval arms race, okay, they benefited from economic trade. In fact, before the war, it was considered to be something that the middle class wanted to have, were German pianos, German quality items, you know, whether it's cameras or anything else. But the naval rivalry caused them to pull apart. And there were also aspects, again, Germany was a very young country, its diplomats were just not as sophisticated as the British. And so, you know, Germans had great national pride, but so did every other country. All of those things I just mentioned, M-A-I-N, militarism, imperialism, nationalism, you know, colonialism, none of these things by themselves was enough to cause the war. So again, why did it get there? Okay, And I mentioned Fashoda, the first Morocco, second Morocco, and the Balkan Wars. And you can see that the Balkan troubles here, and here are the major powers, John Bull, Russia, the French, the Kaiser, and Franz Joseph of Austria-Hungary, all sitting on the lid to keep things from boiling over. Okay? So you can see the great powers are trying to prevent this going to a major war. They didn't want that. Nobody wanted that. Even the Kaiser, I mean, he's accused of wanting warfare, but the fact is that he was just as much like the others, saying, we do not need to do this. So all these crises that happened from 1898 to 1913, no major war. Again, why did this happen? Well, here's what happened, is that when there was an assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, and his pregnant wife Sophie in Sarajevo in June 28th of 1914. That was the spark. Because up to that point, there had been a lot of problems of the Serbian nationals within Austria-Hungary. Serbia had an independent country. It had grown to a much larger country at the expense of the Ottomans. And now, Serbian nationalists trying to basically get Serbs within Austria-Hungary to revolt and pull out of Austria, assassinated the heir and his wife. That, of course, could not be ignored. Regicide, when you've got most of these countries having kings, except for France, okay, killing kings and their heirs is not going to be something they can allow. So you would think, well, that means that Great Britain and Russia and Germany, right, and Austria-Hungary, even Britain is going to say, you know what, let's sit down and figure out how we're going to punish Serbia. That didn't happen because Austria decided we're not going to wait for other people to tell us what to do. So they pushed ahead to try and punish Serbia. And there were elements within Austria-Hungary that wanted to go to war. They absolutely said we don't have to, you know, ask permission from anybody else. But they didn't need one thing. They needed one thing absolutely. They knew that if they attacked Serbia, Russia would back Serbia. And so they'd have to fight Russia. Well, the only way they felt they could fight Russia is because they had to have German help. They had to have their alliance, you know, even though there was an alliance, that doesn't mean they were going to come through. So the Austrians made sure that the Germans were going to help them. Well, it did far more than that. The Germans gave them what is now called the blank check. They basically told the Austrians, whatever you want to do, we'll back it. If you go to war, we're going to go to war. If you want to, you know, slaughter the Serbs, you know, we'll cheer you on. Whatever you want to do, it's okay. You know, just make sure you keep us in the loop. So that's the impetus that started the first step.
Dana, can you just elaborate on that a little more?
Yeah.
Because, okay, suppose Germany did not do that. Suppose they had like a qualified support or something.
That is a very good alternative history thing. Because one thing that I want to add to that is that, and this is one of those things that historically, if this had been a little bit different, it would have been really fascinating. The president of France, Poincaré, was visiting Russia at the very moment in July when all this went down. And so he was there with Samsonov and the main Russian thinkers and foreign ministers and all that. And they were able to get together face-to-face and talk about this. So, and they learned from people who gave them information that this ultimatum was going to go to Serbia. And Russia was going, well, I don't know what we're going to do. And France, Poincaré, said, we'll back you. The same sort of blank check. The same blank check that Germany gave Austria-Hungary, France gave to Russia. That was huge, okay? Because Russia and Nicholas II was like, I don't know if I want to do this. And he backed off at least once of doing the mobilization.
And that's because they picked up on the fact that the Germans were going to give...
That's right. Absolutely. Again, it's reaction. It's like, oh, we know they're going to do this. We hear the Germans are going to do this. We better do this because we can't afford not to. Mobilization was regarded as a declaration of war. And the reason is it took so long to get men, especially the reservists, out of civilian life, have their equipment, their uniforms, assemble in their units, and then be transported by train to wherever they had. This took weeks. Okay? For Russia, people thought it was going to take months. So Russia had to start first. Well, they started first, as you can see here. Germany said, well, we have to mobilize. The Kaiser contacted by telegram his cousin, Nicholas II, and said, please don't do this. Please, we won't mobilize if you don't. And Nicholas went back and said, well, let's stop the mobilization, which made Samsonov and all the Tsar generals go crazy. So what they did is they finally browbeat Nicholas into letting the mobilization go forward. And then Samsonov said, take the damn phone away from him. Okay? We don't want Nicholas changing his mind again. All right? So you can see that things are starting to move forward and get and escalate. And what you said about the blank check, there's two blank checks here. You know, yes, Germany may have gave a blank check, but so did France, okay? If Germany had not given Austria-Hungary the blank check, my gut feeling is that Franz Joseph, the emperor of Austria-Hungary, would have done what he did every time before, because every opportunity they had to declare war on Serbia, he said no. No, no, no. He said this would be the end of Austria-Hungary, the end of our empire. He was absolutely correct. But with the blank check from Germany, it's like, no, we also have to move forward.
Based on what I've read about it, is that they kind of, like Hotzendorf and the military staff,
yes,
the army staff, kind of, kept Franz Joseph kind of like, they kind of...
worked around him?
Kind of the same thing was going on with Nicholas.
Yes.
I mean, diminish.
Yes.
Diminish. And so that he really didn't want to go to war with Serbia, but it's almost like we're going to go ahead anyway.
Those countries needed their head of state to say yes to war. Okay. So Franz Joseph and Kaiser Wilhelm ultimately had to say yes. Because if they had said no and stayed with that, there's no war. Okay. So the fact that they did this and they were bullied into it, they were manipulated into it, all that is true. I've got the next slide I think is going to show why, one of the reasons why they did this. Oh, wait a minute. Well, everyone, by the way, is fighting a defensive war. Even though they're all doing this well in advance of a war, they have to appear like, oh, no, no, we're doing it because they're doing it. You know,
right.
Everybody is saying this. Okay. There is also no clearly articulated strategic goals. We fight because we fight. That's one of the reasons why it's going to be such a difficult war to stop.
Exactly.
You know, there's no goal other than to fight.
For anyone.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nobody.
What were the objectives?
No one had thought this through. No one had thought this through.
Sounds familiar.
Okay. And of course, we're all fighting for defense. It's like, who wouldn't fight for your motherland like this? You know, home and heart. You know, your wife, your girlfriend, your family. Why wouldn't you do this? And by the way, this is what every nation is saying. I just showed you a British poster, but the fact is every country said this to their people, all right? But Germany, Russia, and France are all going to attack. So it's a defensive war, but we're going to attack right off the first day, okay?
Well, you got to get your licks in first, right?
Yes, but it's sort of contradictory. I go back just for a second. I will answer your question because hang on one more. Okay, so one of the other things that's happening is that, and I love this poster, this is just great, you know, the Germans are this beast, you know, ravishing the woman and beating the crap out of everything. The French and Belgians are reacting to German atrocities. Well, remember, Germans lost, so we only hear the other side's version. But the Germans are also going against Russian atrocities, whether they're true or not, because the Russians, when they invaded East Prussia, are destroying German property, they're destroying homes, they're, you know, the rape, pillaging, and all that is going on.
Did that actually happen?
Yes, but not to the same level as what Germany did in Belgium, okay? Not to that same level. All right, so anyway, there's enthusiasm in 1914, and historians say, oh my gosh, all these people were swelling, you know, the cheering people at the trains and everything. By the way, that's our notable person that's going to lead World War II. That's Adolf in the crowd there. But actually, although there were lots of people out here listening to the Kaiser and others talking about war, there were millions of people that were apprehensive about this and not enthusiastic, including the labor unions, which initially had said, you know, all we have to do is say no. All the workers unite together in an international. All we have to do is say we're not going to fight, and there's no war. Well, when push came to shove, French workers were French, German workers were German, and all these appeals to patriotism overcame that sense of unity and internationalism among the workers. Okay, so this is what I wanted to get to. One of the reasons 1914 is pushed, because you can say, well, Dana, it still doesn't explain why 1914 is pushed so hard. Okay, Germany and Austria did the numbers, and France made a huge investment in Russia in terms of railroads, in terms of being able to build an infrastructure which improved their mobilization time. So instead of taking a couple of months, it took only, not as fast as Germany, but it only took a few weeks longer. So what happened is the Russians were going to pass them. Austria-Hungary and Germany thought that Russia would surpass them in every category, including manufacturing, ability to put troops in the field just as quickly, and that meant now the largest army in Europe would have sufficient weapons, sufficient ammunition, and mobilize just as fast. What do you do? This is a preemptive war. You know, the German general staff and the Austrian general staff are saying, we can't wait. We can't afford to wait till 1917. That's what will happen. We will never be able to go to war because we'll be at a disadvantage. This is our last best shot. And you can see the Russians. See how far that, this is the view of it. It's like
Russian steamroll.
Yeah, the Russian steamroll.
It's like Russian soldiers as far as the eye can see.
As far as the eye can see, the Russians just, you know, maybe they're not that good. Maybe they're led brutally by their officers. Maybe their officers are not exactly the greatest geniuses in the world. But then again, they could afford to lose half their army and they'd still outnumber the Germans. Okay, so you can see that why people like Germany and Austria-Hungary are like, oh my God, we have to do something. Which is one of the arguments that finally convinced Franz Joseph and Kaiser Wilhelm that this is our last best shot. Take advantage of it and we'll catch them. Now, they did not realize that France had been in talks with Russia, and they were ready to go. I mean, France mobilized within like an hour after Germany did, okay? So they were ready for this, and so Germany was not going to have the advantage they thought they were going to have against France or Russia. And of course, you know, everyone was, it's a defensive war, it's a moral war, so you can see that Austria is beating up on Serbia, so Russia's going to beat up on Austria, Germany's going to beat up on Russia, here comes France in to beat up on Germany, and John Bull's back here saying, wait a minute, I want to get in this, okay? These are cartoons at the time, so you can see that people had a good sense of humor and also were very cynical about why this war is happening. You know, we think that, hey, we're the only ones who have this kind of sophisticated cynicism about politics and moving into Iraq, you know, and doing the Gulf War and all this. Oh, no. There were newspapers, at least in countries that allowed freedom of the press, that were already doing this. And so they had a very good idea at the time exactly how bad this was and why. But a lot of the people, again, for patriotic reasons, are going to fight for their countries. All right, so here you have, this is great. There's the evil German standing with the pistol having shot poor Edith Clavell, British spy, the nurse who was a spy. Now, most people was like, she's a spy, you know? It's like, but again, Germans just didn't seem to get popular opinion, okay? It was like, you're just giving the British something. Would the British have shot? Oh, yes, the British were executing prisoners. I mean, spies. Okay? So that was something being done, but this was just terrific. A woman? Oh, my God. You know, the beast, the Germans have done this, right? It would have been far better had they just imprisoned her, you know, and let it go, but they didn't. So what the bottom line, and this, again, is coming back to Michael Nyberg, is that World War I was the cause. This is very important. It was the cause, not the result of national hatreds, okay? So the war inflamed this nationalism, inflamed patriotism. Before this, there were no incidents like this for the British to hate the Germans as badly as they did. But once the war started and incidents like this happened, then all of a sudden you have a hatred building. Now you really have a problem. And how do you turn this off? If you don't even have war aims, you don't have goals, and now you just hate the other side, well, there's only one way to finish it. Kill all of them. All right, so, and in 1914, this is a very important thing. These are French dead. Rather gruesome photo. In 1914, in the month of August, 1 month, the French are going to lose 20% of all the dead in military losses that they're going to suffer for the entire war. 1 month. They were not ready for the scale of destruction. The Germans are going to suffer also, the Russians, the British are going to get hammered, right? But the French do it in such a way because they attack. There's been a lot of talk about, well, they had these red pants on and blue coats. I was like, no, no, don't worry. They're all covered in dust. That has nothing to do with it. But when you send a regiment of guys in close order across an open field and the Germans have heavy artillery, you can pretty much predict what's going to happen. And if they get close enough, then the machine guns are going to finish them off, okay? 20% of dead in 1 month. This was like a stunning shock to the military on all sides. And they all had different solutions to it, okay? That's beyond the scope of what I'm going to talk about today, but I'm just trying to tell you that they reacted very differently. First, there's a shock because these kinds of losses had never been happening before. You know, when you have entire battalions wiped out, that was a rarity in the past. During the Napoleonic Wars, the American Civil War, it was very, very rare that you would see a regiment or a battalion wiped out to the man. This was common in World War I. You know, there were towns in Great Britain that they had recruited the PALs together, companies and battalions, and they were all killed or wounded or disappeared in the first day of the summer. I mean, the shock, the emotional and psychological shock this caused was just, again, unprecedented. And they reacted differently to it. In fact, it hardened them. That's another thing. The losses didn't sit, they didn't sit back and say, oh my God, this is the stupidest thing we've ever done. We have to figure our way out of this. It was like, no, we will avenge these dead. So we're going to push harder. We're going to kill more Germans. Okay? No peace. They shall not pass, etc., etc. So, again, 1914 is actually going to be, what they did is they actually dialed it down. They didn't do as many stupid attacks like they had done before, okay? Despite the fact the Somme was pretty awful, all right, and I have things to say about that, but basically the French in particular and the Germans all said, oops, we're not going to keep doing that. So they changed, all right? So even in 1916 and 17, the French and the Germans now, even with Verdun, okay, they did not have the kind of hideous losses on a monthly, weekly basis that they did in 1914.
Well, but they had horrendous losses, though.
Yes, they will, but it's true attrition where no month will ever be as bad as the first month.
Oh, okay, because it was over a longer period of time.
Yes, that's right. So it adds up. It's the length of the war that's going to cause that, not any one of them. There's not going to be that kind of level of slaughter as there was in August. Okay, so, all right, now what? You got a war, you got people hating each other, you're stuck with it, and how do you stop it? Well, if you have no strategic goals, how can you stop it, right? So, you know, you can see that they have some great posters from World War I. Which, by the way, although there were posters in the American Civil War, because I've seen them, most of them are just recruiting posters to join a regiment or a battery or something like that. There was never anything like this. This level of propaganda, and we think of propaganda as a negative term, it's come that way. But initially, propaganda was meant to be basically disseminating information to help support your country, okay? And so there are a lot of artists and clever graphic people who came up with these great posters like this. So, you know, here we are squishing the German dachshund, okay? And you saw the one that was the beast that was the Germans and so forth. There's some great ones that the West had. But the problem with this is like, okay, except for killing the dog, what are you trying to accomplish? And they couldn't say that. Later, this is very important, when we got involved in the war, Wilson came up with 14 points. He says, if you accept these 14 points, Germany, it was the first time somebody actually wrote down, you know, self-determination and all the other things, you know, then we can talk. We can stop this war and talk. So Wilson actually came up with a reason for people to stop, which is what's going to happen in 1918, because when the Germans realize that they're losing and things aren't going well, they immediately accepted his 14 points. Okay? Why is that important? The United States gets involved in the war, as you know, in 1917 through 1918. But the United States is a co-belligerent. We're not an official ally of Great Britain and France. Why is that important? Because we don't need their opinion. We can set our own terms, and we can accept German overtures of peace. So when the Germans said, we accept your 14 points, America said, okay, we'll stop fighting. Which then made the British and French just go crazy. Because, you know, the largest, freshest army in Europe, with 2 million more guys on the way, are now stopped. They're not going to fight. It's like, what do you do, right? Well, you have no choice, but you have to go along with Wilson. Okay, so again, here's another great one. Lusitania, the mother drowning with her infant. You know, I don't know how many mothers and infants were on the Titanic, but we do know now it was loaded with ammunition and other things, right? But again, it was like, this is just going to make people upset like crazy. In fact, as a personal story, Germans in this country, people of German descent in the United States, were harassed, were vilified, and they were harassed so badly that a lot of them changed their names. You may know Mountbatten. The same thing happened to his family in Great Britain. They had to change their name because they were German. Germanic, not necessarily German, but you know, German state, and they came from a German state, small state. I can't remember the exact one, but they had to change their name.
Battenberg.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's some, well, it was something von Battenberg or whatever. Yeah, so they became Mountbatten. Okay, my family's name was Mosher, M-O-S-H-E-R, German. My mother's side was German. It was like, no, 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 this is not working. So they changed the H for an I, Mosier. Sounds French, doesn't it? Yes. I actually told somebody in France that, and he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, there's no such word in French. I said, no, there isn't, but they wanted to survive the backlash against Germans. So, again, how do you get out of this? How do you compromise or get out of it, right? If Wilson had not come up with those 14 points, Britain and France were already exhausted. Russia's out of the war. Germany won. It beat Russia. When a lot of people in World War II say, how stupid could Hitler be? The Germans, you know, Napoleon went into Russia and he lost. He says, yes, but the Germans won in World War I. That's all they remember is that they won. They forced the Russians to give up a huge amount of territory and all these reparations, and then they sent all the divisions west to do their last big offensive.
Dan, I'm a little confused about the timeline here.
Yes?
Okay, okay, you got the U.S. Army's already in France, and you're talking about the Germans understand that their army's starting to collapse.
In 1918.
Okay, so yep. That's before the armistice we're talking about, right?
Well, yes, yes, just before, points. Right. So what happened was, Wilson had already put down his 14 points, which initially the Kaiser and the Germans said, you know, because they're winning, right? They're about ready to not rush out of the war, and they have confidence that they're going to beat the French and the British. So they don't accept it. But when they start losing in late 1918, then they say, we accept. Okay, thank you. And that's the end of it. And Wilson said, okay, let's negotiate, which, of course, Britain and France was not happy with.
Well, that's what brought on the armistice, though.
Yes, that's correct. Okay, so, and here's another great poster. Look at the Statue of Liberty's been destroyed. Clouds of German bombers. I don't know where they came from, but, you know, since they only had a couple hundred mile radius at most.
Canada.
So here are the Gotha bombers destroying New York City. And this was, like, really effective initially. I mean, a lot of people, remember, they never seen stuff like this. There's no TV, okay? Movies are not that sophisticated, so this is the kind of stuff that you look at this and you can just envision, oh my God, the Germans are going to kill us. It's like, no one sat there and said, wait a minute, there's not a bomber on this planet that can reach that far, right? But it didn't matter, because the only option worse than fighting is stopping, okay? It's like, we got to fight, we got to keep doing this, which is why everyone was surprised in 1918 when the Germans said, thank you, Wilson, we accept, so let's stop. Okay. Even in 1918, remember, these are all cartoons from the period. Okay, as soon as it's over, what's the first thing y'all want to do? Blame the other guy. You cannot go to your people. Great Britain, David Lloyd George cannot go to the people of Britain and say, well, we're partly to blame for this, so we're not really going to hammer the Germans. Or the French would say, it's like, no. Not only are we blameless, we didn't start this war. We had nothing to do with it. It was enforced upon us. But in addition, we're going to get reparations out of the other guy. We're going to just squeeze them and make them pay for everything we lost. So you can see that all the nations are like pointing at each other. Serbia's pointing at Austria-Hungary, Germany's pointing at France, blah, blah, blah. And they're all, you know, it's like, you're to blame, you're to blame, you're to blame. And this is from Chicago Tribune, by the way. So this is more of a neutral opinion. This is the United States. There were people in the United States that looked at this saying, these people are all idiots, you know? They're just, the whole thing is just, not, and of course, here's truth and justice, dead. You know, it's like, who did it? Well, they did it, he did it, he did it. No, I did it. You know, so. All right, here's a German poster. See, I am objective. There's a German poster, right? It says, for the Fatherland, fighting for the Fatherland, and join us, okay, with the Guards Cavalry Rifle Division, okay? And there he is, of course, where's the horse? Okay, there's no horse, right? And here he is with a grenade and a rifle, brave young soldier. And we know one of the best novels ever written about World War I is All Quiet on the Western Front, which is written by
a German,
right? The Germans are not like this monolithic, fascist, you know, evil group of people. They also looked at this war and said, this is crazy. This is nuts. There were a lot of people who were opposed to this. Even soldiers who had tried, you know, patriotically and with their countries. Yes, sir. Are you here for the lecture?
Sorry, I'm late. Traffic was horrible. Let me sit up here where I'm hard of hearing.
Oh, okay.
I'll sit up close.
All right.
Sig from the Museum Alameda.
Ah.
Good morning.
Good to see you, sir.
Terrible traffic.
Anyway, so as you can see, as I had mentioned before with the Western nations, France and Great Britain, Germany is in the same boat. How the war ended up being fought was just totally separated from any political goals. They really couldn't articulate it other than we had to fight because we had to fight. Of course, there is one thing evil looming on the horizon, right? And what is that, okay? 1914 basically set up everything that was going to come later because of the way the war was fought. Without having political goals, with having almost endless slaughter, it caused the societies to tear apart. Their belief in their institutions, in their Kaiser, in the Emperor, all that just went away because they just couldn't believe in their governments anymore. Again, the unprecedented level of death and destruction had basically undermined everyone's belief in their system and in their country. You know, we gave everything. We were patriotic. You know, why did this happen? Why is this such destruction? Why are we losing everything? So it gave rise to the Bolsheviks in Russia, helped by the Germans who wanted to knock Russia out of the war. But it also gave rise to the fascists. There was a proto-fascism before the war. There were a lot of military men who thought that you had to have... It was sort of like Darwinian attitude that our country has to have this cleansing. We have to kill as many of our people who are weak so we end up with only the strong. This is serious. I'm not making this up. This is like crazy thinking, but you know, it's like they were drinking the Kool-Aid, okay? And they actually believed this. So Conrad, who is the chief of staff of the Austrian army, who wanted war constantly, war, let's just do this, right? Conrad is one of the darlings of the Nazis. He, of course, there's no justice in this planet proven. He not only survives, right? He does not. He's not a war criminal. He's not arrested or anything else. And he lives out for a long time, right? Hey, we had a good war. Didn't work out, you know, but I was right anyway. Okay, and the Nazis loved this guy. So you can see that there were fascist ideas, there were Bolshevik ideas, and of course they led 20 years later to remember our hero from the picture in the crowd. Okay, well there he is, slightly done better in life, you know, and. I have this question, and it's in a separate talk, but I will tell you that some people have asked me, how was there any way to stop this? Because of the way the Versailles Treaty was written and the punishment that was inflicted on Germany, how could they have stopped that? And one of the things that was presented by Poincaré, our hero, the French president, tried to tell Wilson, why don't we break up Germany? They broke up the Ottoman Empire into a bunch of little countries just by drawing lines on the map. That's Iraq, that's Syria, et cetera, et cetera. And they also broke up Austria-Hungary into component countries, mostly along ethnic lines. Why didn't they break up Germany? Well, as a matter of fact, Poincaré said, let's do that. Let's break it up so that when Hitler comes to power, he would have had Bavaria. That's it. Okay, so Germany might not have been a unified country that could have then allowed for the Nazis to take over as quickly as they did and then use its industrial base and its millions of people to start World War II. But that leads to another question, okay? If you can restrict the influence of the fascists, if you can stop the Nazis, right? What does that mean? Well, who was the strongest and greatest threat in 1918-1919 to Europe? Ta-da! Yes, Bolshevism. One of the reasons that they reject, two reasons for rejecting Poincaré's suggestion. One is that Wilson is sick. Wilson is really sick, and he's gone through months of treaty negotiations, He's just fed up. He doesn't want to hear anymore. But even Poincaré and David Lloyd George are sitting there going, you know what? That's a nice block right here, you know? Let's, if the Germans are basically able to stop and be a buffer for the rest of us to the Bolsheviks in Russia, that's a good thing. So one of the reasons they did not break Germany into a bunch of little countries is because they wanted to be able to survive and provide that buffer against Russian expansionism. But if all that had not happened, you know, there was, this is the exaggerated thing where all of Europe, of course, has fallen to the Soviets. But if there was not a Nazi Germany, if there wasn't a big Germany, if there wasn't a Nazi Germany, and there wasn't World War II, we might have fast-forwarded into another alternative history, the Cold War. Okay, so now the Cold War is against a Bolshevik Europe, mostly unified under Russian control, and the United States, which is protected across an ocean. Okay, but if you are into alternate histories and you want to talk about, you know, how it would have been different, okay, why did we end up with a nuclear bomb? And why did we end up with missiles and everything else? That's because of German scientists, wasn't it? And they left Germany because either they were Jewish and had to get out of town, or they were captured by us when we defeated Nazi Germany in World War II. But if there is no World War II, and if there is no pogrom against the Jews in Germany, they have no reason to leave. So who ends up with all the German scientists? We don't get them. So now we're facing a Cold War where the other side has the guys who design the missiles, design the jets, and design the nuclear weapons. So, I'm a little bit biased, but I think it ended just fine for the United States, okay? Terrible wars, both of them, but I think that ultimately, you know, and of course here's the Soviets, you know, with their kids, she's happy, they're happy, and they're about ready to crush capitalism. So, you know, can't get better than that. That's my talk about why World War I happened, why it was so difficult to stop it, and how it ended up making Europe into a different situation after World War I, why World War I came into World War II came into being. But Jack Green will talk more about that later today.
Yes.
And you'll have a chance to do that. Go ahead and hit the lights. Thank you, Bert. Yes. I'll take questions. Go ahead, Jack.
Well, I just wanted to say, I haven't heard Daniel's talk before, and it's amazing, and vice versa, and it's amazing how there's continuity between our two talks, which I think you'll get a kick out of later.
Well, geniuses usually share the same ideas.
Serendipity.
Yes, exactly. No, there are a few things. I really love war games. One reason I like war games is for the what-if possibilities. You know, for me, it's fascinating to see what would have happened had they done something differently, tactically, strategically, operationally. Yes, Jim?
Well, I wanted to come back to the initial. Can you go back to the first slide you had about the MAIN, you know, the militarism, four, you know, interconnected elements there. There we go.
Yes.
Militarism, alliances, imperialism, and nationalism. Well, it looks like to me, based on the stuff that I've studied recently, also what you just mentioned today,
yes,
is that the militarism did come to the fore, in that the fact the marginalized Nichols, marginalized Francis,
marginalized Kaiser Wilhelm.
And Kaiser Wilhelm. Yes. And so that's, to me, it's the military staff.
Right.
Is driving.
Yes, absolutely.
They're the ones that put it right over the top.
Yes.
Because you said they're really listening to really listening to their kings.
Yes.
You know, their supposed heads of state.
Right.
They wouldn't have done it.
I think that the first one up there is the biggest one, because the military in each of these countries really was the driving force, and there was not like a break or a regulator, basically, by having civilians being able to influence it. Russia was an autocracy. I mean, the Tsar basically decided everything. Okay?
The Tsar and the kings were supposed to be the civilian control.
In theory, yes. But these guys were easily manipulated. You could not have had three weaker people. Franz Joseph was not weak when he was a young man. He was a dynamic, strong leader who kept Austria together. But now he's like in his 80s, I believe.
Very, right? Very
so, and he's like, he just lost Franz Ferdinand. He didn't agree with him, right? But he's lost two. He lost his son, Rudolf, right, who committed suicide. He lost Franz Ferdinand to assassination. He is not happy with the situation. He's old man tired, right? And he gets beaten on by Conrad, who just won't stop. The guy shows up and says, declare war, declare war. He doesn't want to stop it. Kaiser Wilhelm is like the last guy to talk to him, convinces him, right? And so the Germans kept pushing on him as well. And Nicholas had the same thing. You know, take the phone away from this guy. He's going to change his mind again. So had they been stronger, any one of those three been stronger for whatever reason, you know, and stood up to him, Kaiser Wilhelm II was not Frederick the Great, okay? Can you imagine Frederick having his foreign minister say, you've got to do this? It's like, no, I don't. Say, I'm Frederick the Great. I decided we're going to do this, okay? So, and Poincaré, by the way, just to let you know, is that initially, the presidency in France was honorary. It was like, you know, a figurehead position. Poincaré decided that it was going to be more active and an actual politically influential position. So he did this, and again, it was unprecedented, okay? So he jumped in there and told, which is not technically his right to do it, he's the one that told Samsonov and the Russians, we will back you, I guarantee it. He had no authority to do that. He could have gone back in the chamber and would have said, what did you say? He said, you tell him that. He said, no. But they decided to go along with it, okay? Because by the time they got back by boat, ship, from Russia, things had gone so badly that the French had to, you know, do their mobilization. Which, by the way, just to show you how worried they were about it, is they took seriously these labor unions, okay, and the international and everything, and there also was a huge pacifist movement against war in general, okay? And as a result, there were a lot of people in the government and the military who thought, damn, you may have 20 to 30% of our guys not show up when we tell them they're mobilized. We may lose that many guys. And what it ended up being was like less than 7%. They were like, whew, we dodged that bullet, because they were so worried about it. Patriotism came to the fore in every country. And so when the labor unions had to choose between the labor union and the international and their country, they chose the country. And there's one other thing I wanted to mention, because I always like to say this. It is a joke, okay, but I always like to have the alternative viewpoint. One of the reasons they said this war could not happen, could not be sustained, it could break out, but they'd have to resolve it soon, is because when you pull millions of men off of farms and out of factories and out of business, you can't sustain that. How are you going to run your country? All the bankers and all the economists said, we can't do this, because this is crazy. You know, you can't just shut down the economy. Why did it keep going?
Women.
That's right, because women came forward and left their homes. They were encouraged, but they were willing to leave their homes and everything, because there were a lot of opportunities for women they'd never had before. And they went to the factories, they went, and they did every job just about you can imagine. And that was also in World War II, as we know, with Rosie the Riveter and all the women that did that, okay? So women came forward in millions and worked, not in the homes anymore, but in the factories, the places making ammunition, making weapons, running, you know, streetcars, doing whatever men had done before so that those men could go to the front and be slaughtered. Okay? So.
And forced labor.
Well, World War I wasn't as bad, okay? It was World War II, but World War I did have some of that, absolutely. So, who is to blame for the war continuing?
Women.
That's right.
Wait a minute, why is that a joke?
You're welcome.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. We have some flyers that show the whole program, or you have your program book. If there are any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them. No? Well, thank you so much.
How do you spell Michael's last name?
Nyberg, hang on. There it is. N-E-I-B-E-R-G, Nyberg. He's German. Obviously, he's biased. By the way, this country, what was it? And at one point, 25% of this country was German ancestry.
Oh, I think it's
yeah.
Well, still, Germans are the most ethnic.
The largest.
90 million Americans.
Actually,
he's from Pittsburgh. But yes. Intelligent.
And 6 million voters.
Okay, so,
voters
so I have another joke, which I always ask people, which is, who was the greatest German general and the greatest German admiral of World War II?
Nimitz.
And Eisenhower. And they're saying they weren't for German, so oh, German ancestry. I forgot the ancestry. Yes.
Yeah, you forgot that.
Yes, exactly. All right, thank you.